Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So this is the second lecture on chapter 3, right? The economic decision makers. And what we're doing in chapter 3 is that we're looking at the overview of the main economic actors. There's the household sector, and then there's the business sector, there's the government sector, and then there's the foreign sector. And everyone who spends money has to fall in one of these four categories. So we've already talked about the household sector in terms of some recent history and trends. And then we talked about the business sector. We talked about the different forms of corporations and sole proprietorships and things like that. And so now what we're going to do is that we're going to talk about the government sector and then the foreign sector, and then that will finish chapter 3. So let me put the slide up here. What is the role of government? The government is responsible for these things. And I'm going to go through this list. But the point here is that why do we need a strong government in a free market system? Well, that's one. I mean, that's what we're going to talk about. But the point is that some people think, well, the less government we have, then the more freedom we'll have. But that's what I'm going to show you is that that's not true. In order for a free market system to function, we need a strong central government. Now, there's a right way of doing things and a wrong way of doing things. So that's not to say that everything government does and the bigger the government is, the better. That's far from the truth. But we do need a strong central government in order for a free market system to work. Because, you see, the right laws give more freedom than they take away. For example, we have a law in this country that says that we have to drive on the right-hand side of the road, correct? Yep. Now, you might say, well, that's an infringement upon my freedom. I mean, shouldn't I be free to drive on whatever side of the road I want? Well, if we didn't have a law that said you can't drive on the left-hand side of the road, then what would it be like driving down the highway? It'd be scary, right? I mean, it'd be like dodging cars. You know, some people was on the right and some's on the left. And everyone would be creeping along real slow, correct? But see, if we have a law that says you can't drive on the left-hand side of the road, that gives us, what, the freedom to drive 65 miles an hour down the highway and not worry about someone coming along and banging into us, right? Well, what I'm saying is that I'm just using this as an example. What I'm saying is that the right laws give more freedom than they take away. Okay, the right laws. Some laws are good and some are bad, but the good laws give more freedom than they take away. I remember once, several years ago, I taught mathematics in the inner city of Detroit, Michigan, and for those years, I remember the police cars had the sign across them that says they said the Protectors of Liberty, and so that's really what I'm going to talk about, how laws and a law enforcement authority actually protects our liberty if it's done correctly. So the first one here is establishes and enforces rules of the game. See, the economy can be like a game. And like any game, you have to have rules. And those rules have to be enforced. And in order to have rules, we have to have a strong central government. We have to have rules that give our system a structure and it establishes contractual law, for example, that you can go and enter into a contract, even with a job. You when you get a job for somebody, you're really entering into a contract. You're saying to your employer, I will do this in these hours, and your employer says, well, if you come to work certain hours and perform these duties, then I will do this, you see. Each party says, if you do this, I will do that. And that's a contractual law. Well, I mean, we need government for such things. Okay? And we need government to back up these laws. In fact, if you were to ask me, why has the United States prospered in the past more than many other countries, I would say that one of the main reasons is that we have always been a country that has honored the rule of law. Now, let me explain the difference between the rule of law and the rule of man, because most of the world operates according to the rule of man, although we're headed in that direction. Here's the attendance. Let's say that you're driving down a highway and the speed limit's 45 and you're going 65. And the policeman stops you and says, I clocked you at 65. That's 20 miles over the speed limit. So I'm going to give you a ticket. So he gives you a ticket, and according to the law, so many miles over the speed limit, your fine is so much, or you maybe have to report to court. But all these things are part of the law. Now, that's called the rule of law. Now, let me explain to you what the rule of man is. You're driving down the highway at 45 miles an hour, and the speed limit's 45 miles an hour, and the policeman stops you and says, I clocked you going 65 miles an hour, and so I'm going to give you a ticket. Now, notice here, you weren't going 65, you were going 40. You were going the speed limit. Now, in this situation, and this is what's true in most of the world, what that person in authority is really expecting is, see, this ticket may cost you a couple hundred dollars. But the policeman knows that if you give him $50, that maybe, he'll forget about the ticket. Because that was the whole reason for him stopping you in the first place. So you give him $50, and you go on your way. Now, that's called the rule of man. In other words, we have someone in authority here. In this case, it's a policeman. And that person in authority takes action that benefits himself. Okay. In other words, he puts himself above the law for the benefit of himself. And this is true in so much of the world. I mean, things are people get the airline tickets, for example, not based on availability, but based on who you know. It becomes the buddy system. It becomes if you've got the right contacts and you know the right people, then you see you get. See a free market system, who gets? Well, in a free market system, those with the money and those that want it the most get, right? But there are other ways of doing it. We could say, well, who gets? Well, those who get are those who are most favored. Well, why are they most favored? Well, that could be for any reason. And that's called the rule of man. Okay, now a free market system can only operate in accordance to, as long as we respect the rule of law. Okay, and once favoritism gets into it, and once we start picking winners and picking losers, then the whole system begins to break down. See, unfortunately, that's as we're entering into an era here of more government control of businesses and free market, then more and more decisions are being based on other reasons other than the free market. The government can pick winners and losers. Remember, I think I told you about the simple thing was with General Motors and Ford Motor. Who accepted the government bailout money? Ford or General Motors? GM did. And as a result, what could GM do? Sell cars for less money than Ford because they're getting this money from the government. And so Ford loses out in sales because Ford said, well, we're not going to accept the bailout. And so GM now has an edge in the market over Ford. So the government says, GM, you win, Ford, you lose. See, picking winners and losers. Now, I use this as an example because they're both American companies. You know, it's not always, well, one's American and one's foreign or this or that. I mean, it's just like, a favoritism can be for any reason. But that's called the rule of man, okay? The rule of man. And what we're going to learn in here is how a free market system works, but then how we can modify that system. Of course, there's a right way of modifying it in terms of rules of the game. Anyway, let's look at the next one. Promotes competition. Promotes competition. There is a tendency that when a business establishes itself in a market, that as it grows, it gains market power. And it can use that market power to the detriment of its competitors. And then what happens is that we have less competition. Now, this is what happened around the turn of the 1900s, around the turn of the century, you know, from 1800s to the 1900s. This country had a lot of what are called trusts. We had the steel trust. And we had the tin trust, and we had the, you know, this trust and that trust. I mean, these industries, instead of companies competing against one another, they in turn instead cooperated with one another, and they acted as if they were a monopoly, because instead of competing, they chose what price to charge, and then they all agreed upon that price. So the consumer could either pay that higher price or couldn't buy anything at all because there was less competition. See, with less competition, the consumer is then taken advantage of. So in the early 1900s, we passed what are called antitrust laws. And the antitrust law says that we have to have a certain amount of competition here. And that if any one company has too much market power so that it can take advantage of that market power to the detriment of the consumer, then that's unlawful. So that's one of the reasons why we need government in order to make sure that you know we have ample competition out there in the market. Okay, regulates natural monopolies. Now, antitrust laws are against monopolies. See, when businesses collude, when they agree amongst themselves what price to charge, then they're acting in unison as if they were a monopoly. But there are some monopolies that are actually beneficial, and these are called natural monopolies. For example, when you live in a locality and you want to buy power, how many choices do you have and who to buy that power from, you know, like electricity?
Yeah.
One. How come? Because whoever company in your area, and of course this differs from area to area, but in any one area, these companies have a monopoly. Well, why don't we have more competition? Well, let me tell you why. If we have more competition, well, first of all, in order to supply power, like to the New River Valley, there's a lot of sunk costs involved. We have to build a power source, like we dammed up the New River, build a big power plant, hire a bunch of people, run a lot of wires, put up a lot of poles. I mean, there's a whole lot to do here. That may take years and is very expensive before 1 kilowatt of energy can be provided. Now, one thing you got to understand about investors is that investors will move where they can make the most money. In other words, there's nothing written in stone that investors have to invest in the power business. You see one thing about entrepreneurs is that they're always looking for a good deal. It doesn't make any difference if they're in the shoe business or the sporting goods business or the clothing business or the restaurant business. It doesn't make any difference because the same characteristics that will make you successful in one industry will make you successful in the other. And all you're interested in is a good vehicle. All right? So in other words, investors will invest in the power business if that's a good investment as compared to other places they could put their money. So here we have something where the upfront costs are very high. It takes a long time to provide this source of energy. And in order to make this profitable, we have to make sure that we have enough customers. Now, the New River Valley has X number of people, and investors might say, well, now, if this is the population, and if 95% of the population buys power from us, then this will justify our investment. But if only 50% of the consumers in this area buy power from us, then we can't justify our investment. I mean, there's better places to put our money. So how do we encourage those investors to come and provide power in this area? Yeah, we say, hey, look, if you come and you invest your money, we'll pass a law saying that you are the only one that can provide power in this area. Well, now, if the investors have a monopoly, they know that, okay, this is the population. We know that it's pretty safe to say that 95% of the population will buy power from us, so we know what our customer base is going to be. And see, that eliminates a lot of uncertainty. And so that makes investors come in and make the investment in the first place. See, now there are other reasons too. I mean, what would our skyline look like if we had 5 to 7 power companies in this area, and each power company had their own set of wires? So yeah, or if one company can provide power to everybody, if we had 5 or 6 or 7 companies providing us power, that's a big waste of natural resources, right? I mean, they each would have their own set of poles and their own set of wires, and there'd be a lot of unnecessary duplication here, right? So, see, for both those reasons, we have what are called natural monopolies. And only government can make this possible. See, this is another reason why we need a strong central government. Well, in this case, yeah, in this case, society has benefited from having a natural monopoly. And I'm glad you asked that question because I really should have gone a little further in my explanation. Whatever the government gives with one hand, they almost always take away with the other hand. I mean, why did Ford Motor Company turn down the bailout? Too many strings attached. I mean, these companies that accept government money are putting them under the authority of the federal government, and there's a lot of loss of freedom here, and so same with these natural monopolies. In other words, what the government says, yes, you can have a monopoly in this area, but we have to approve your price structure. And if you want to raise your price, you have to validate why you have to raise your price. And you can only raise your price if we allow it. See, the government gives these investors a monopoly power on one hand, but then on the other hand, they take away because they say, well, you can't just charge any price you want. Now we learn a whole lot about this in the microeconomics, but I don't go into this in great detail, but I just very briefly here just want you to be aware that there are such things as natural monopolies. Yeah.
So what? Okay, back to the example that you were giving about the electricity company.
Yeah.
The example you were giving about the electricity company. Mm-hmm. What if they start cheating the consumer? Sorry.
Well, then there are laws. I mean, you know, people go to prison, and I mean, there are laws against that, and those laws can be enforced. Yeah, just like anything else. Okay, what other reason do we need a strong central government? And what we're looking at here is what can't a free market system provide for us? What are some of the weaknesses in a perfectly free market system? And one of the weaknesses in a free market system is that it can't provide us with public goods. Well, now, what is a public good? A public good is something that once built is available to anyone and no one can be excluded from it.
Like a national park?
Yeah, a national park would be a public good, exactly. Now, another public good are simply roads. Now, let's suppose that we didn't have government, and we wanted to build a roads, between here and Dublin, and Dublin and in Christiansburg here. What would the incentive be to build those roads, and how would those roads be paid for?
Tolls.
The only way to do it, I mean, again, there's no government here, right? So we can't tax because there's no government to tax, correct? So the only way to do it is for investors to buy up stretches of land, and then for them to build roads on that land, and then... when you and I drive on those roads, there would be toll booths, and we would pay tolls. I mean, that's how the roads would be paid for. Now, let's say that between here and Dublin, and there might be 10 or 12, 15 different toll roads. Now, imagine what driving would be like. I mean, you drive for a while, get off, pay a toll, get on another road, drive for a while, pay a toll, get off. And since there's no government, there's no uniform road. I mean, who's to say how wide the road should be, or who's to say what the road should be made out of? I mean, it would be whatever the investors chose. I mean, some would choose asphalt, some would choose gravel, some would just go on the cheap and just have mud roads, dirt roads. Some would be wide, some would be narrow. Now, imagine driving between here and California this way. You see how impossible that would be? So what's the only way to have uniform roads and anyone can drive on them without paying tolls?
Government.
And government taxes us and then use that tax money to build the roads. That's a public good.
Would schools also be considered?
Schools would be a public good, exactly. Right. That'd be another good example of a public good. See, without schools, without public schools, who would be educated in our society? Only those who could afford it. Do you know that? Why is it that your tuition here for this course is the third the price as the same course in the same transfer credits as Tech or Radford? How come you're only paying a third the price for this course? And by the way, I'm even using the same textbook as Tech, Virginia Tech uses McEachran for their economics, for their macro and micro. So how come your tuition is... No. I mean, some universities are, but I'm talking about Tech. Let's just talk about Tech or Radford. The what? Well, I'm talking about your tuition. How come you're only paying a third of the tuition as a Tech or Radford?
By the government.
What now?
They're supplemented by the government. There's more funding coming to the community college from the government than the 4-year state institution.
Exactly right. Y'all hear what she said? See, your tuition is more highly subsidized than your tuition will be when you transfer to a four-year school. That is why, see, our expenses are the same as a four-year school. We've got classrooms and we got teachers and we got the same things they do, but yet, we can charge a third the price because the state of Virginia subsidizes your tuition more than your tuition is subsidized at a four-year school. Now, even though it's a third the price, how much would you be paying for this course if it were not for government assistance? I mean, if this were strictly a business here at New River Community College, and we just had to, pay all our expenses, and we had to make a profit, and our income came from tuition, how much tuition would you all be paying? Or even more, because even at Tech or Radford they're subsidized, but not just as highly as here. Yeah, a private school. See, it would be essentially a private school. I mean, private schools are expensive. And in that case, who would get the education? Well, those who could afford it. And those that couldn't afford it just wouldn't get the education. So you'd have a great imbalance here. And a lot less upward mobility, see? Let me go back to the roads just very quickly, just for interest's sake. What taxes pay for the roads? No.
Car tax?
No. Gasoline taxes. Every time we buy a gallon of gasoline, a certain percent of that is taxes that go specifically to building and maintaining roads. Therefore, who pays the most taxes? Those who drive the most. The more you drive, the more taxes you pay. Now, is that a pretty fair way of doing it?
Yeah,
that's a pretty fair way of doing it.
When gasoline prices skyrocket, is there
going to
be more tax money
into that? Well, I don't know. It depends how the tax law is written. And I don't know all the ins and outs of that. But I'm guessing that they tax based on, so many cents per gallon.
I read somewhere where that was one problem when the gas prices shot up. Everybody quit buying gas and the tax revenue went down tremendously.
Yeah, and that hurt our ability to build and maintain roads. Yeah, that's a good point. So anyway, the point here is that if it were not for government, then we would have no public goods. And you can see how many problems we would have if everything was determined by private enterprise and private investors. Okay? Another reason we need government is to deal with what are called externalities. Now, there are negative externalities and there are positive externalities, but we're concerned with what are called negative externality. Now, what is a negative externality? A negative externality is a negative byproduct of the industrial process. In other words, we like all the cars that Detroit gives us, but we don't like the pollution that goes along with them. See, the pollution from cars and other factories is what is called a negative externality. It's an unintended consequence of the industrial process that is harmful. Now, I once used to think that if business people could simply have a social conscience, that we would not need to have pollution. I mean, don't these business owners know that running a pipe out their back door into the lake, to get rid of all their liquid waste is terribly polluting to our rivers and our lakes and causes all kinds of problems. And I mean, don't they know that all this soot going up into their chimneys causes all kinds of problems? Or taking on machines that don't have adequate safety devices on them, that's harmful to workers. I mean, if they simply had a social conscience, then and took it upon themselves, then we wouldn't have such an environment problem of pollution. But why is that not possible? Why is it not possible for a business owner to have a social conscience? I mean, you show me a business owner with a social conscience, and I'll show you a business owner that'll go out of business.
When we're concerned about profit.
Well, of course, because profit is the thing that keeps them in business. But why can't they have a social conscience?
It costs money.
It costs money. And what are we talking about here? I mean, you're going down the right road.
Competition.
See, let's say that all of us here were competing against one another in some industry. And you develop a social conscience. Let's say we're in the paper business. We all manufacturing paper. Now, to begin with, our costs are pretty much the same, and our share of the market's the same, and the quality of the paper is the same. In other words, we're pretty much identical businesses. Now, everything else being equal here, because you now have a social conscience, you put scrubbers in your smokestack so that you don't pollute the air so much. Or you find ways to get rid of your liquid waste without polluting the rivers. But what's going to happen to your costs when you do these things? They're going to be higher. And if your costs go up, I mean, here's price and here's cost. If your costs go up and your costs go up and your costs go up, I mean, what are you going to have to do to your price? You're going to have to raise your price.
And then he's going to want to buy your product.
Why? Well, because of competition. I mean, people walk into a store. They've got four choices. Yours is one of those choices in terms of buying paper. The quality is the same. The number of paper you can buy, everything is the same. But your paper is 20% more than the competitors. Now, are people going to say, well, I'm going to pay 20% more because this company here is trying to help the environment? So I'll pay, $1.20 for this paper instead of a dollar. I mean, is that what? I mean, sometimes, yeah. But I mean, how many people won't even know it? First of all, and secondly, even if they did know it, they still wouldn't care. And hey, the dollar cheaper. I mean, I'm getting the same paper for less money, and this is what I'm going to buy. Well, yeah, that's really the point I'm making. I mean, the point I'm making is pollution, for example, can be a problem, right? Now, if a free market can't address the problem, and why can't a free market address a problem? Well, because of competition, because it's not going to happen. I mean, with no government involvement here, we'd all be choking to death on pollution. So what's the only way to tackle a pollution problem? Government. And that's really my whole point. You need government to establish uniform rules of the game, guidelines, hopefully that are reasonable. Of course, then you get into, well, what's reasonable, what's not, and what's fair and what's not. But, people can disagree on that. But economists uniformly agree that, hey, without a strong government here, there'd be no way we could address our pollution problem. See, this is one of those areas that we need a strong central government to deal with negative externalities. See, unsafe working machines is another negative externality. I mean, it's cheaper to buy machines without safety devices on them, and if workers get maimed and hurt, that's they should have known that before they took the job. And why? Well, because it's cheaper, right? It's the same thing. I mean, if you've got a social conscience and you take on machines, they've got a lot of safety devices on them, but they're more expensive, and as a result, you've got to raise your prices above your competitors, well, next thing you know, you're out of business. So how do we make sure that workers have adequate safety devices on the machines?
again, government. See, this is government sets the guidelines. Hey, you know, this is we're and now, of course, let's say, you know, you're one of these businesses. I mean, let's say in this case, you're the one with the social conscience. Now, before you, if you followed your social conscience, you'd go out of business. So now, you see, you can follow your social conscience. Now, someone else that you're competing against, they might not have a social conscience, but they're forced to play the same game you are. See what I mean? So those with a social conscience are now free to follow social conscience because now they're not going to be underpriced by their competitors. I mean, everything else being equal here. I mean, we're talking about, these negative externalities and the cost of minimizing those negative externalities. Okay, promotes a more equal distribution of income. In the earlier lecture, I showed you that there was a law that says that he that has will be given more, and that thing that you don't have, then what you don't have is taken away from you. Remember that? If you've got $1,000 and you put $1,000 in a savings account, what does the bank do? Well, for you though. I mean, what's your incentive to put in a savings account? The bank pays you interest, right? Now, why did the bank give you money? Because you had money. You had money, so what did you get? Money. Now, if you want to buy a car, a $20,000 car, but you don't have the money, so you got to finance it over 3 to 5 years, and that $20,000 ends up costing $24,000. Why was $4,000 taken away from you? Because you didn't have the money. Because you didn't have the $20,000, what was taken away from you? Money. See, that thing that you don't have is taken away. Now, because this is simply a law, I mean, this is just the way the world works. As a result, as time goes on, ever heard the adage, well, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Well, there's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of truth to that. And so one thing that the government does is that it promotes and tries to promote, in theory, an equal distribution of income. You know, though, that's why we have a graduated or what is called a progressive income tax. We have different tax brackets, and each dollar of income is taxed based on the bracket that dollar falls in, and the higher the bracket, the higher the percent. The what now?
The flat tax?
No, it would be the flat tax would not be the same, because with the flat tax, everyone would pay the same percent regardless of your income.
Yeah, but because people are making more money, they're still paying taxes.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that one of the justifications in a graduated income tax is that if you make more money, not only do you pay more in taxes as you would in a straight income tax, but the larger percentage of your income you pay, you see. And the justification there is that it is more, it helps distribute more, income. It takes more from the wealthy and, you know, gives to the not so wealthy more. Now, that's the justification. Now, all economists, I mean, we've got a whole chapter on, government and taxes, and we're going to get into this in much more detail. But you know, virtually every, I'd say most economists would agree that a flat tax would be much more efficient and could raise a whole lot more money at a lower rate than the system we have. See, in reality, what is one of the largest reasons we have our tax system as it is? Our tax system is very complicated because, I mean, the central law is very simple, but all the exceptions to the law will take you volumes and thousands of pages. And even though it's recognized that a flat tax would be much simpler and much less costs involved and could raise a lot more income on a lower tax rate, why don't we do it? All right. Now, why these loopholes, or why? I mean, what? Now, who is in control of changing the tax laws?
Congress.
Congress. Now, why would Congress not want a flat tax?
Power,
power, power. You see, the way it is now, if a special interest group goes to Washington and gains favor, then they can have laws passed favoring their industry. Okay, that's called. There's a name for that, by the way. It's called rent seeking, and it's a term that's going to be used a lot here because it's a big deal about what's happening right now. But rent seeking, you know, let's say you own a business, and you've got a choice of taking $100,000 and putting it into improving your product, or putting it into marketing, or you could take the $100,000 and spend it in Washington, D.C. and influence legislation to have laws passed that will favor your business. Now, which are you going to get the biggest bang for the buck? Well, if you decide that you can get a whole lot more from that $100,000 by putting it into Washington, D.C., then that's what you're going to do. And that's called rent seeking. Rent seeking. And right today there's a whole lot of that going on. You know, I mean, with this bailout, I mean, all kinds of businesses are lined up. I mean, there's long lines. You know, they're all, you know, in line for special favors. And you know, and instead of putting their energies in making a better product, well, they figured, hey, you know, it's a lot more. Better. It's better for us to put this money, you know, into Washington D.C. And so, in the past, that's what the government has done. And that's why our tax law is so complicated, because it's all the exceptions. Because politicians have, you know, have used it to, you know, as you know, to for whatever, you know, for whatever reasons they have, they've used the tax law, you know, to benefit themselves or benefit the type of world that they think we ought to live in, you see. But the justification, see, sometimes the justification for something is really not the real reason for it. Now, the justification for this graduated income tax system that we have is that it more evenly distributes income. Now, let me real quick, but we will cover this in more detail. Let's take two different tax brackets, 15% and 21%. And the taxable income break off is, let's say, I'm just picking a number out of top of my head, let's say it's $30,000. In other words, $30,000 taxable income is in the 15%, and above $30,000 falls in the 21% bracket. Your taxable income is $35,000. What's your taxes? I want to say that again. I'm not really looking for a number, but how would you calculate your taxes? Okay, the break off is $30,000 taxable income, 15%, 21%, right? Your taxable income is $35,000. How would you figure your taxes? Would you pay 35% under $35,000? No, you don't. What do? You pay 15% on $30,000, and then you pay 21% on the $5,000. You see, in our income tax, every dollar is taxed based on what bracket that dollar falls in. I mean, a multimillionaire will pay the same taxes on his, you know, first income, you know, up to a certain amount as anyone else. See, and then it's only dollars above that that are, it's only those margin. That's why we call our income tax a marginal tax system. That, you know, the margin. Remember, we talked about the margin. It means the last unit. Well, our income tax system taxes our income on the margin. Every dollar is taxed in according to what bracket that dollar falls in, or how that dollar is earned too. I mean, you know, there's earned income and unearned income, for example. When you make money through a wage, that's earned income. If you make money on rent, that's unearned income. And by the way, which faces the highest tax rate? No, earned income faces a higher tax rate. Unearned income faces a much lower tax rate. That's one of the reasons, you know, benefits of, you know, having rental property. And capital gains would be another example, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And but capital gains has its own tax, percentage. So it's not only in where that dollar falls in terms of how much tax you're going to pay on that dollar, but how that dollar is earned that determines how much you're going to pay on it. And that was really my point. See, what I'm doing here is I'm trying to give you an overview. I'm trying to give you the bigger picture. See, what do I do in my lectures that you don't get from the book? Overview. See, I'm trying to get you to step back 10 paces and see the bigger picture. That's always what I try to do in my lectures, because the book will give you the details. But it's very easy to get lost in the details and really not know the bigger purpose of what we're doing. And so I'm always trying to emphasize, you know, see the bigger picture. See the bigger picture. And that's really a big part of what, you know, these first four chapters is. It's just, you know, just hitting the highlights. Just trying to give you the larger picture. Okay, another reason we need government is that it strives for full employment, price stability, and economic growth. Now, this is something that it hasn't always been this way. Before the Depression of the 1930s, even though we had some public works programs and government involvement in areas, if people back in the 30s and before the 30s did not look to government to solve their problems, if you were to engage in an oral history of the Great Depression and you could go back and you could interview people during the Depression and you said, who's the cause of this 25% unemployment and all this misery that we're going through, and most people would say it was ourselves. You know, we did this or we did that. Well, today, I mean, you know, a lot of economists think that we're going to go through a similar situation, if not worse, than was the case in the 30s. We are in a free fall here economically, right? Y'all know that, right? You know, unemployment increased more last month than ever before in any single month in history. I mean, things are falling faster today than they were in the early 30s in terms of unemployment and the economy wise. So we are literally in a free fall economically. But today, I mean, if you interview most people, they would say, well, the government did this or the government did that, or the government can do this or the government can do that. And that's why we have this, you know, the newspaper today, you know, the headlines was that Congress just passed almost a $900 billion, what they call a stimulus package. Now, $900 billion, you know, our deficit this year in 2009 could increase $2 trillion. That's how much money we could borrow in this one year. Now, the total debt is only $10 trillion. So, I mean, we are going to greatly increase our national debt. And that has got serious consequences that I'm not going to get into now that we'll talk about later. But why has the government gotten so much support in all these grandiose spending programs? because our attitude toward government has changed from what it was, you know, like in the 30s. That we expect government to, in fact, in 1946, it was 1946, right after World War II, that a law was passed that gave the government this responsibility. I mean, before 1946, Franklin Roosevelt during the 30s engaged in a lot of public works programs, but it wasn't really recognized as a legal thing or a viable thing for government to do or something that they should do. And in 1946, we said, yes, this is one function of government. I mean, we need government for what? Well, we need government for, there's other reasons that I haven't even talked about. We need government for a uniform system of weights and measures, for example. I mean, if I say that this is a foot, and I go to California, I mean, how long is a foot to people in California? No, a foot is a foot, right? Because government says a foot is so long. A pound weighs so much. I mean, this is we need a government to establish that we can all agree on these things. I mean, we need government for all kinds of reasons. But what I'm saying is that it's a modern thing to say, well, one of the reasons we need government is to promote full employment and economic growth. See, that's a modern, it hasn't been around that long. Okay, at least not in the United States. And that's something that is gaining steam here. Okay, well, let's see. Let's move on. How does the government establish and enforce? Okay, I sort of let's see. Competition. I talked about all these things. What is a monopoly? What is a natural monopoly? The downside of a natural monopoly, at least for the owners of the monopolies, is what the government gives with one hand, they take away with the other in terms of pricing. What is a public good? We talked about that. How does government provide for public goods, taxes? Of course, see, here's another interesting concept. And something that is going to be—it's very so prevalent today. If the government spends a dollar, then you and me is going to pay for that dollar here and now, regardless of where that dollar comes from. Now, the government spends an extra dollar. What's the first place that dollar can come from? Come on now. Most obvious would be taxes, right? The government spends an extra dollar. Where does the government get that extra dollar? Taxes. Right? So how do you and I pay for that dollar? By higher taxes, correct? All right, now, let's say the government spends a dollar, but it doesn't increase taxes. Where's another place it can get that dollar?
Borrow it.
It can borrow it. Now, who's it borrow it from? Well,
whoever's got
the money, right? I mean, people who've got savings can afford to put money, and of course their incentive is to earn interest, right?
Is that kind of what it's saying?
Oh, that's exactly what a savings bond is. See, in fact, the only way that the government borrows money is by selling a bond. Every penny ever borrowed from the federal government has been from a sale of a bond. And savings bond is one type of a bond that government sells when it borrows money. But here's the kicker. Okay, let's say that the government spends a dollar, doesn't raise taxes, but borrows that dollar. Now, how are you and I going to pay for that dollar? Here and now. Maybe we'll pay for it in the future, but I'm talking about we're going to pay for it here and now. How how are you and I going to pay for that dollar here? And of course, I'm not talking just about a dollar here, right? I'm talking about trillions of dollars. You know, I mean, the deficit this year could be as high as $2 trillion just in 1 year. The deficit is how much the federal government borrows in any 1 year. See, the debt is how much the government owes overall. But the deficit is how much they borrow in any 1 year. So that you know, $2 trillion that I'm talking about, and that's only a projection, you know, 2009, but it's a deficit. But so we're talking here about trillions of dollars. Now, if the government borrows the money, how do you and I pay for that money here and now? The what?
Taxes?
No. Because, no, we've already covered taxes. So how do you and I mean, how does that money come from our pockets?
Well, because we choose to borrow it. So we choose to invest.
But how do we pay for it?
With our money, like,
but how? In what way do we pay for that dollar? Huh? Not yet. That comes the third, but we're on second. No, again, that's the third thing. That's the third way of getting money. But we didn't borrow money. I mean, we didn't create money. We borrowed it from people who had it. No, I'm saying, how do you and I? Tax, you know, citizens, how do you and I pay for that dollar here and now? What was that? No. Let me explain it. All right. Banks have a certain amount of money to lend. Now, this money comes from savings, ultimately. All right. They got X number of dollars to lend. Who's going to, in a free market now, anyway, who's going to get that money and who isn't? Yeah. In other words, who's the bank going to lend the money to? Yeah. In other words, those people who are going to pay the price. Remember, in a free market system, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Price. Well, what is the price of borrowed money? Interest. That's the price that lenders charge to borrow money. Now, if there's not enough money, now we live in a world of scarcity, right? There's not enough money, you know, of this borrowed money here available to go around for everyone who wants it. So how do we decide who gets the money and who doesn't? Interest. See? Interest. That's the price of borrowed money. Now, if the government is borrowing huge amounts of money, what happens to our problem scarcity for other people who want to borrow money? There's less available for you and me and other people, right? There's less available. The problem of scarcity is more acute than before. So in a free market, who's going to get the money? Higher interest. So when the government borrows money, how do you and I pay for that money here and now? Higher interest. Every time you borrow money for an automobile, or you borrow money, you know, however you borrow the money, you're going to pay higher interest than you would if it were not for this government borrowing. See what I mean? I mean, interest rates are going to go up because that's the way markets work. So everyone who pays interest is going to, you know, they're the ones who are going to pay for this dollar here and now. Okay, the government spends a dollar. We don't tax it. We don't borrow it. What's the third way of getting that dollar?
Printing
it, to create it.
But doesn't that also promote inflation?
And that's really the answer to my question. my question was, okay, if the government creates the money, how do you and I pay for that money here and now? And the answer is, inflation. With higher prices, then every time you and I buy something, we're going to have to take more dollars out of our pocket. See what I mean? And so, and by the way, you know, when the government creates money, so a small part of our money supply is in dollars. Okay, I mean dollar bills. Most of it is just electronic money. It's just credits and debits. And the way the government can create money is that the government sells bonds to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve then creates money by simply crediting the government's account by X trillions of dollars or billions of dollars.
So we don't have enough, like, actual, like, I guess, would it be gold?
Oh, no. We haven't. See, we've been off the gold standard since the 30s. Huh?
Nothing backs your money. So it could become worthless.
Right. And that's what inflation is. See?
Is that kind of what happened in Zimbabwe?
Oh, yeah, Zimbabwe. That's a good example. What the inflation rate, 1,000% a day or a week. I mean, they've had inflation rate in the millions, on an annual basis.
This was about two years ago, even more recent than that, I think.
Yeah.
It's like today.
Yeah.
Their money is worthless. Like, it equals out, so they get paid like 36 cents
a month. Yeah. See, our money can become almost worthless if it's just like anything else. When something becomes more plentiful and easier to come by, then what happens to the value? It goes down. Now, if you're talking about dollar bills, let's say, although, most of the money isn't in the form of bills, it's electronic money, but if you talk about, dollars, if dollars are more plentiful and easier to come by, what happens to the value of each unit? It goes down. Well, if the value of each unit goes down, when you and I go to buy something at the store, guess what? It takes more of them because the value of each one is less than before. And that's what we call inflation. Now, we have a whole chapter. Well, we have a whole chapter coming up on unemployment and inflation. So, this is something we talk about in great detail. But all I'm saying now is that there's no free lunch. And it's wrong thinking to say we can spend this money now, but we're going to pay for it later. Now, we may pay for it later. Yes, that's true. But we're going to pay for it now. Right here and now. One of three ways. If the government spends a dollar, then you and I are going to pay for that dollar either higher taxes or higher interest rates or more inflation.
So is that how the government is able to say that they're going to lower taxes and increase government spending at the same time? Through inflation?
Well, ultimately, that's the only way out of this thing. I mean, there's no doubt that in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to have a hyperinflation in this country. That's unavoidable. Because that's the only way the government can pay for it. And, of course, the government wins because if the government owes, let's say, $100, but we have a 100% inflation rate, well, when they go back to pay that $100, guess what? Yeah, see, $1 can do what $100 was when they borrowed it. See what I mean? They get a bigger bang for their buck. So the government wins with inflation because they can pay back their debts with depreciated dollars.
I wouldn't necessarily refer to tighter inflation, but I don't think
that. Well, we'll see. I mean, I no one can tell the future, but it's alarming that the economy is in a free fall and yet we're spending this huge amounts of money and most of that money is being borrowed. And there's not enough money. See, other nations are in the same boat that we are.
Globalization. Right?
So it's global. And so the only way that this money can ultimately come from is to create it. And that's what's going to cause inflation. We're going to get inflation all over the world, much more than before. Now, hyperinflation, sometimes we do tend to exaggerate. And you're right. I mean, the word hyper is the wrong adjective here, but we're certainly we're going to be faced with an inflation problem. That much is for sure. I'm scaring you. Well, it's a good time to be in school. I should say that, and not out in the workforce. Well, let's see. I'm going to move. How many slides are in this? You've got. I've talked about
49.
This. Oh boy, I'm never going to get done here. How does government deal with externalities? I've talked about that. How does government promote more equal distribution of income? I've talked about this. More equal distribution of income. Of course, a lot of that, I mean, with higher taxes, but then we've got these transfer payments where, you know, the government takes from this group and, you know, it's like Social Security. I might as well just go ahead and explain some of these things because I can't finish this today like I was hoping. But Social Security, when John Doe receives a dollar in Social Security payment, where did that dollar come from? And that someone else was the someone else who paid Social Security taxes. In other words, the government takes from people who pay Social Security taxes and gives it to those who receive Social Security, correct? And that's what's called a transfer payment.
So food stamps and welfare and things like
all that are transfer payments. Yeah, you take from this group and give to that group. Now, have you all been reading about this Madoff investor who bilked so many people out of, you know, hundreds and thousands and millions of dollars, and it was called a Ponzi scheme. It was the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. The whole, you know, whole world was, you know, it's been people lost, I mean, huge fortunes because what a Ponzi scheme is, and what this Madoff fella did for so many years, is that you. Now I'm going to talk about, I'm going to relate this to Social Security, so. You know, I mean, I'm making a point here. What a Ponzi scheme is that you convince people that if they give you their money, you invest it and you make them a good return on it. So people give you money, and you give them, let's say, a 20% return. Well, how'd you give them such a good return? Well, because you sold to another group over here, you sold to more people, and you took money, instead of investing your money in the markets and really making an honest return on it, you simply paid the first people for money you got from the latest people that entered into this scheme. See what I mean? And so you're continually paying, you know, people a good return, and you, and what Madoff did for years and years, and the reason why so many people invested with him is because they really did make a good, solid, high return that never varied from year to year. I mean, he just gave them a good, healthy, more return than they could make anywhere else. And when the markets went down, they still got their good return. And they were thinking, man, this guy's a genius, you see. And so they gave him a bunch of money. But when does that whole scheme collapse? Yeah, when you fail to get enough new clients, you see. Now, what happened is that when the economy started to go down, Madoff couldn't find enough new clients to make good on, you know, his promises, and the whole thing had gotten so big that eventually it just collapsed. Now, what is our Social Security system? It's a big Ponzi scheme. Because it's exactly the same thing, because you all know how insurance works. Like, the way insurance companies work is that they collect premiums, and then they invest those premiums in the market, and then they make a return on that money, and then when people make claims, they pay the claims not from the principal, but from the return on the principal. I mean a good solid insurance company, that is their goal anyway. Their goal is to pay out premium, people pay premiums, but they pay out, when people make claims because the insurance is not dipping into their principal. They're only taking money from the return on their principal, but the principal is always there because the principal is always making more and more money in the markets or in interest, you see. But is that the way Social Security is? Well, no. Social Security is strictly a pay-as-you-go program. The government takes from Peter on a Tuesday and pays to Paul on a Wednesday. See, none of it is saved. You see? So, it's nothing but a Ponzi scheme.
But there has to be more and more people contributing.
Exactly. There has to be. Yes. Yes. And you all know, you know, who the baby boomers are. You know, people born like from 1946, 47 to about 1953. Well, you know, that was after World War II, and there was a big bulge in the economy. It's like a, have you ever seen a boa constrictor that, you know, swallowed a pig or something? Well, you know, it's a big bulge, and that's what's kind of like moving through, you know, through our society. And right now, it's exactly the time when those people are beginning to retire. And so, it's just like what Madoff faced. You've got fewer and fewer people paying in the system as compared to the amount of people receiving from the system. And just like his Ponzi scheme, it's bound to fail, or at least to be highly subsidized. See, the only way out is to highly subsidize from the government. In other words, they collect $1,000, but they owe $2,000. So where's that extra $1,000 going to come from? Well, just, you know, general taxes. Yeah, general taxes. See, I mean that's one advantage the government has over Madoff, because, you know, he couldn't create money or tax people to make up the difference, but the government can. See, but again, I mean, that's a big, you know, that's going to be a big strain in our economy. Just at a time when, you know, we've got these, you know, when we're headed into a very serious recession, maybe even a depression, but we'll see. Well, now you all know why economics is called the dismal science, right? I didn't quite get done with this chapter, so we'll just pick this up next time, okay? So I'll see you all next time.